Astonishing Legends Network.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the show. This is the third time I'm doing it because my mic wasn't on the first two times I did it. I'm so glad you're here. I just want to say to my Patreon listeners, thank you so much for your patience. Those bonus episodes are finally dropping. My dog Bowie got his act together. He's putting the shows out. The logjam has been broken. Good dog, Bowie. You're a good boy. I'll give him a treat later. For the rest of you, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, thank you so much for the beautiful reviews. You guys have been writing some amazing reviews. I love it. If you're listening on Spotify, now I'm talking to you guys specifically. Please, if you're a Spotify listener, review the show. Give me 5 stars. Only do it if you're going to give me 5 stars. You're not going to give me 5 stars, don't bother doing it. Just sit back, relax, enjoy the show. But 5 stars on Spotify, I need more reviews. That would be so great if you guys could do that. And also, comment on the episodes. I read those comments. I comment on the comments. So, I'm glad you're listening. I hope you enjoy tonight's show. Let's jump in. Here we go. Lilydale by Christine Wicker. I have always been fascinated by mediums. They attract me and they frighten me. They seem to have the most extraordinary skill a human being can have. They can bridge the gap between the living and the dead. It's like they can see a color the rest of us cannot. They live among us, but they are not like us. They are special. But what if there was a place on Earth where these people were not the exception, but the rule? Well, as it turns out, there is such a place. It's a town called Lilydale. It is a spiritualist community located in Northwest New York State, and it is populated almost exclusively by people who can talk to the dead. What is it like to live in a town where everybody knows your name and everything else about you, whether you want them to or not? Here's where a lesser writer would say something like, "Welcome to Lilydale." But you're dealing with a pro, so I won't. You're welcome. In Lilydale, HarperCollins, 2003, author and journalist Christine Wicker spends 3 years living on and off among the people who live among the spirits. Wicker is an old-school journalist, which I would describe as a person more interested in getting the story than being the story. Her training has told her to always stay objective and skeptical and never take anything at face value. So investigating a place like Lilydale presents a delicious, almost irresistible opportunity to explore the question, is something real going on here? Or is it nothing more than a traveling circus sideshow that set itself down 146 years ago and has survived ever since, taking money from the curious, the grieving, and the hopelessly gullible? Well, guess what? Along the way, she finds her objectivity and skepticism challenged. And before she knows it, the story of investigating Lilydale becomes a story about investigating her own values, beliefs, and firmly held convictions about who she is, how she lives her life, and finally leads her to ask the biggest and most important question of all. If the dead speak, why won't they tell us the winning lottery numbers? I love these kinds of books. I love stories about a person struggling to reconcile their religious beliefs with the cold, hard facts of reality, especially when their religious belief is atheism and the cold, hard facts of reality are a meeting with a medium that simply cannot be explained away as a cold reading, coincidence, or fraud. But wait a second, Richard, you ask. What if it was the other way around? What if it was a believer who loses their faith when they discover that the paranormal event they experienced has a rational, mundane explanation? Well, no, to be honest, I don't like those stories quite as much. But what's cool about this book? It has both. What I've realized after decades of reading the books on my paranormal bookshelf is that it almost always comes down to personal choice. If a believer is committed to believing, they will believe, no matter what. And if a skeptic is committed to a philosophy of disbelief, nothing will sway them. Most of us go through life searching for our preconceived notions about the world to be confirmed. Most of us never truly change, not in the big foundational ways that really matter. Does Christine Wicker change? Well, I've read Lily Dale twice. Once in the summer of 2010, when I was stranded in Shreveport, Louisiana, working on a show about a supernatural town of a very different kind from Lily Dale. The second time was just this week, and each time I came to a completely different conclusion. Christine Wicker was a religion reporter for the Dallas Morning News in 2001 when she began visiting Lily Dale each summer to meet the residents and, of course, test the mediums. From the start, this was a story about belief. From the book, quote, "My first question about the people of Lily Dale was, do they really believe it? The second question was, how does it affect their lives? Sometimes there's a third question hovering behind the others. This one is just for me. I want to know how such a belief would change me." Wicker's relationship to belief is what you might call complicated. She was raised Southern Baptist, was born again at age 9, and was absolutely devoted in her faith that Jesus was her personal savior. Up until the moment she went to college, that is. At that point, she did a complete 180 from devout believer to arch skeptic. From the book, quote, "I was educated out of the faith. College so amazed me that I swallowed almost everything my professors said, and all of them seemed to be saying that the personal savior has no place in the life of smart people." Still, while she says she is no longer of the faith, she is, quote, "uncommonly open to people's beliefs," which I take to mean, I don't believe in anything anymore, but I'm totally cool with it if you do. I will say this. For Christine Wicker, there is no immediate threat, no need to resolve the issue of skepticism or belief, no need to take a side and then live with the consequences. The world isn't pressing her into a decision that will force her to declare herself one way or the other, irrevocably and for all time. I, on the other hand, was not so lucky. It was 2009, and my wife Susan and I were in a bad place. For the first time ever, we found ourselves on separate sides of an issue for which there was no compromise. One of us would win, and one of us would lose. And there was no real joy in winning because we both knew the loser would live in a timeline of resentment that may not ever truly resolve. The problem could not have been simpler or more clear-cut. Susan wanted to have another child, and I really, 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 really didn't. When my first wife, Michelle Goodwin, and I split up, and I was newly single at the age of 36, I thought that a lot of life's questions for me had already been answered. I had fallen in love and gotten married and had kids. I didn't have to wonder if those things would ever happen for me. They had. Now, I didn't have to do any of them ever again. I had no intention of ever getting married again, and certainly no intention of ever having more children. More than anything, I wanted to be unencumbered. I assumed I'd have a series of girlfriends drifting in and out of my life, all of them low stakes and basically friendly with no big emotions involved, no personal risk. In other words, I'd have the single life I never had in my 20s. And meanwhile, I'd still be a dad to Owen and Spencer, but I wouldn't have to do it with anyone. I could just be the sort of parent I wanted to be without having to cooperate or compromise with anyone. I felt like I'd already done too much of that. But then came Susan, and along with her came a relationship full of risk. She wasn't risky. I never doubted her or my feelings about her. The risk was getting involved seriously with anyone at all. I was risking my autonomy, because when you're with someone, really with someone, sooner or later you do have to cooperate and compromise. And I had come to see that as a lethal threat to my idea of myself as an independent person. I wanted to live a life where my priorities were my kids and myself and my career, and that's all. I didn't want to worry about taking care of another grown-up. I didn't mind sacrificing myself for my kids, but for another adult? No, wasn't going to happen. Over time, though, with Susan, I did learn to compromise. For example, Susan wanted to get married, and I didn't. In my mind, marriage was the enemy. But Susan didn't see it that way. "We're not going to change," she'd say. "This isn't going to change. Besides, when have we ever not had fun?" She had a point. So I trusted her, and it worked out. Then she wanted to have a baby, and I didn't. "Come on," she said, "you already have two. What's one more?" "Have another, like an hors d'oeuvre." So we did. We had Dashiell. Now, the first year with a new baby is always hard, but that first year with Dashiell was especially hard. My mom died, and my writing career wasn't looking so good either. Two pilots that I had written that were on the verge of being produced suddenly died. Then there was the Writers Guild strike of 2007 and 2008. It lasted almost 4 months, and once it was over, I was having trouble even getting a development deal set up. Our income had dropped drastically. We were 2 years into owning a house we could barely afford, and it was becoming clear that Susan and I had very different ideas of what needed to happen next to make us happy. For me, it was creating and running my own show again. Miracles was long over, canceled 6 years earlier and growing so small in the rearview mirror it was barely visible at all. The overwhelming, looming reality for me was getting clearer every day. While Susan wanted another baby, I wanted another show. The first one made me so happy. All I could think about was having another, like an hors d'oeuvre. With Miracles, I had been lucky. I had written something that expressed what I cared about and who I was. And it got made. So, like a gambler at a craps table that had been hot but was now cold, I kept thinking my luck had to change. Just one more bet, one more roll of the dice, and everything would go my way again. At the time, in the summer of 2009, my best shot was something called The Gates. It could very easily be described as a sort of supernatural Desperate Housewives. Here's a quick description. Nick Monahan and his family move to an exclusive gated community when he is hired as their private chief of police. What Nick eventually discovers is that not everyone who lives inside the gates is human. Vampires, witches, and werewolves have secretly made this place their sanctuary, among other wealthy humans, and they must keep their secret at all costs, while at the same time trying to control their various unholy urges and their deep, centuries-long antipathy for each other. In other words, it was the perfect TV show. The idea was not mine. The genesis came from producers at a small production company called Little Engine. They pitched me what you just heard, and I loved it. And the three of us went to work creating not just a pitch, but an actual pilot script. ABC showed interest, but the development process was dragging on and on and on. And true, it wasn't really my show. It was a co-creation, and I would not be the sole showrunner. I would have to cooperate and compromise. But with every passing minute, I grew a little more desperate and a little more broke until nothing in the world mattered more to me than this show getting on the air. It's all I thought about. It became, in my mind, the thing that was going to save me. And maybe Susan felt the exact same way about having a second baby. Susan was one of those women who loved being pregnant. No morning sickness, no horrible, debilitating aches and pains, and something about whatever chemicals and hormones were dashing around in her system, it made her glow. She said she felt better than she ever had, and it was a feeling she wanted to have again, a feeling I understood all too well. A cold, aching loneliness grew up all around me, and beneath the loneliness was a feeling of deprivation. Without a show, without a direct and obvious platform to put across all my thoughts and feelings, I felt like I was suffocating. The weight of the family and the house and the bills was making it worse. And now this. She wanted another baby. It was like a nightmare. I'm drowning. I'm desperately trying to swim for the surface and break through and breathe air, but I can't. And in my dream, it's Susan's fault. She was wrapping a baby-shaped anchor around my neck. Susan had always been the one person I could go to at my darkest times, and she would be the light. And now, because of this situation we found ourselves in, that light was cut off to me. I began to really worry that I'd blown my second chance. I'd been handed a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to recreate my life, a clean slate, a cosmic do-over. And what had I done? I'd done just what I swore I'd never do. Be responsible for another person's happiness. I was caught in the same trap all over again. No, I wasn't going to do it. I had done everything, everything she wanted. But there was just no way I was going to do this. She had to understand that, didn't she? She had to understand that what she was asking me to do was impossible and unfair. In a good, healthy, strong marriage, you talk about things. The big things, the things that matter. That's what makes the marriage good and healthy and strong. But when the big thing we needed to talk about turned out to be bigger and scarier than anything we'd ever faced, we stopped talking. I mean, sure, we talked, we said things, but that was just about filling silences. It was a kind of talking that became a way not to talk about the big thing. The big thing stayed locked inside us, waiting. Lily Dale was incorporated as a spiritualist community in 1879. I was picturing it kind of like a Quaker village, but with more Tiffany lamps, oriental rugs, and throw pillows. And I wasn't too far off, except for one thing. Spiritualism is one of the most attacked and hated religions in America. Why? Well, mostly because it runs against a lot of Christian beliefs and values. Mainstream Christianity, in almost all of its denominations, warns against any kind of attempted direct communication with the dead. And of course, that's what spiritualism is all about. As a religion, spiritualism is decentralized. There's no hierarchical structure, no recruiting, no missionaries, and no money. At least not in an institutional sense. It puts the power in the hands of its followers and practitioners, who historically have been predominantly women and gay men. Is it any wonder why it is one of the most feared and despised religions of all? The people who visit Lily Dale today are the same kind of people who make pilgrimages to Sedona, Arizona. They want to personally experience their beliefs through guided meditation, yoga, energy healing, Reiki, chakra and aura balancing, Ayurvedic skincare, reflexology, holistic life coaching, and yes, psychic readings. One of the first stories Christine Wicker tells us in her book Lily Dale is that of a visitor to the town, a woman named Pat Nolte. And as you might guess, at the heart of her story is grief. Pat Nolte was a college professor who, years ago, had left her husband and two sons behind when she went to college later in life and got her degree. Her husband never forgave her, but her kids eventually did, and they moved forward on basically good terms. Her son John started to go through a rough patch while she was away, when he was about 16. Run-ins with the police, mood swings, and some drug use. Then, from the book, quote, "One night, John and two friends gathered with a gun, one bullet, and the idea that a game of Russian roulette might be fun. Pat was sleeping 2,000 miles away. John's friends each took a turn, and twice the gun hammer clicked on empty. As John lifted the gun to his temple, his mother began to dream. She was at a party, and she had lost something important. An ache grew within her, as she searched more and more frantically. What was it? Where was it? When the phone rang, Pat knew the voice. It was her ex-husband. Pat said, "John's dead, isn't he?" He was. And in that moment, quote, "It was as if someone had taken a sledgehammer, aimed it at her breastbone, and let fly. Air gushed from her nose and mouth as her chest crushed into her body. 5 years would pass before she could touch the bones near her heart without wincing at the pain." Like Christine, Pat considered herself a skeptic. In fact, she only knew a little bit about Lilydale when she traveled there to visit a friend and fellow professor, Shelley Takei. She hadn't been planning to visit any of the mediums while she was there, but on the morning of her second day, a small pudgy man waved to her from across the street and called out, "My God, you have the most beautiful energy!" He walked right up to her and asked who Gertrude was. Gertrude was, in fact, the name of Pat's now long-dead mother. The man informed her that Gertrude was here, next to her, right now, hugging her. Pat didn't know what to do with this. She couldn't feel anyone hugging her. Then the man said that her mother approved of what she'd done and was proud that she got her degree and was now teaching. Now, these words affected Pat more than she would have expected. Her mother had given up on her own dreams of a higher education and always regretted it. She died at 42 when Pat was barely out of her teens. And Pat always wondered what her mother would have made of her decision to step away from her husband and children to pursue the goals her mother never had. According to this pudgy stranger, her mother supported her decision, not in general terms, but in specifically accurate words. Quote, "She approved of her decisions and was proud that she got her degree and was now teaching." Then the man, who turned out to be a visiting medium from Ohio, said there was also a young man next to Pat. He was tall and gangly and wearing a baseball cap. This is exactly how her son John looked at 16 on the day he died. Like I said, Pat had no intention to visit a medium while she was in Lilydale. But as it often happens, Lilydale had its own ideas. After this chance encounter, Pat changed her mind and decided to see if she could learn more. You see, Pat had a problem. She was convinced she had killed her son. Not literally, of course, but still. If she hadn't left, if she'd stayed with her family, given up her dream of college and making something of herself and her life, then maybe her son would still be alive. Her visit was with a medium named Lauren Thibodeau. Once they were settled inside Lauren's home, she told Pat, quote, "John's in a wonderful place. It's just beautiful. I see him lying on a table of some kind, and people are standing all around him. They're laying their hands on him, and he's being healed. Everything is wonderful." Pat realized that these words were general and vague and designed to make any grieving person feel better about who they had lost. But then the medium's head shifted as if she was listening to an unheard voice in the room. Suddenly, as if translating from an invisible speaker, Lauren said, quote, "He's telling me that the ceremony you had for him released him. The song and the eulogy, they released him." Lauren was clearly puzzled by these words, but Pat wasn't. She was shocked to the core. You see, 1 year after John's death, Pat had made a secret journey all by herself to a cabin in the woods. She was now convinced that her ongoing grief was somehow holding John back. She wasn't sure she believed in souls, but if they did exist, John had one. And she didn't want to cause it further pain by keeping it earthbound with her sadness. In the cabin that night, she wrote a song for him and a eulogy. The following day, she walked deep into the woods. She read the eulogy, she sang the song, And then, in what she always had thought of as a, quote, little ceremony, she took photos and flowers from his funeral and burned them and buried them and prayed for John's soul to be released. Now, no one knew about any of this. And yet Lauren Thibodeau had just told her in these exact words, the ceremony you had for him released him. The song and the eulogy, they released him. Lauren continued, John is telling me to say that the love you two have for each other is always with you. Pat thought, she used the present tense, the love we have, not the love we had. Anytime you want to feel it, you can just call it up, Lauren said. Think of him, and he'll be right there with you, always. Christine Wicker tells us that Pat Nalty's visit to Lilydale changed her life, but doesn't weigh in on how it affects her beliefs. She is looking for evidence a little closer to home. She wants to know if anything at Lilydale can change her life. But again, she's not in the grip of grief. She does have one dead relative that she is, let's say, curious about, her Uncle Johnny. Christine sits with a medium named Gretchen, who immediately says, I'm getting the name John. But Christine doesn't consider this a hit. She never called her Uncle John, only Johnny. Plus, John is such a common name. Remember, Pat Nalty's son was named John. Gretchen says, quote, was there some kind of interruption at the funeral? I see that the funeral was in two parts. What happened? Christine insists that nothing happened. But then she realizes that, of course, something did happen. Something huge. As everyone gathered outside the church, Christine got into a fight with her cousin, Uncle Johnny's daughter, and the entire extended family took sides. It escalated and almost turned into a fist fight. At a certain point, half of the family just up and left. The family split in two that day and remained divided for years. Well, that's it then, Gretchen said. But Christine isn't buying it. The fight, the interruption, happened before the funeral. Plus, Christine just can't get past the name thing. John, Johnny. Why would she get John instead of Johnny? Even she realizes the better question is, why are you getting stuck on little details? But she is. She knows that deep down, it's going to take a lot more for her to be convinced, really convinced, of anything in Lilydale. Now, it is July 2010. 1 year later for me, and it is midnight, and I am in a swamp in Shreveport, Louisiana. I had worked so hard for this moment. For over a year, I had done everything I could to make this moment a reality, and now it was finally happening. I was executive producer of the Gates. Did you hear the quotation marks around the word executive producer? You should have. One of the crew members had added them to the back of my chair. They put my title in quotation marks. I had no idea who had done it, but it didn't really matter. It could have been anyone. I had lost control of the show, and I had lost the respect of everyone who was working so hard to produce it. The show itself was fine. Even now, it streams periodically on different platforms, and it's really fun. I recommend it. 13 episodes aired on ABC during that summer of 2010. But for me, the summer of 2010 was not fun. I'm sitting in the dark on the banks of a swamp in Shreveport, and I'm sweating. It might be the heat, or it might be humiliation. I've just been yelled at by one of the cast members on the show in front of the entire crew. It wasn't about anything other than their own inability to control their anger and insecurity. Then the cast member proceeded to scream at several of their very nice, professional, non-screaming co-stars. Then they stormed off the set and went into their trailer. and I did nothing. There was nothing I could do, but still. We had an impossible schedule. 7 12-hour days to film each episode, and nothing, absolutely nothing, could get in the way of that. Cast member freakouts, which were becoming commonplace, had to be taken on the chin. In fact, there was every chance I was going to have to go and personally apologize to this person simply to get them back on set to complete the scene. Why was this performer so upset, you might ask? On the face of it, it was because it was late and it was a difficult scene and we were hot and we were filming in a swamp. But the real reason? Fuck if I know. Every TV show is hard. Everyone knows this. And most of the time, everyone goes in knowing this and does everything they can to make things go smoothly for themselves and everyone else. The vast majority of all shows I've ever worked on have proceeded on a philosophy of, let's all help each other get through this. And on only two of them, 2 out of 14, have there ever been any problems. Over time, it's become clear to me. Certain people are just broken. And they're going to make everyone else they come into contact with pay. You almost never know who this person is ahead of time. They're experts at hiding behind charm, at least at first. But you find out soon enough, and by then, it's too late. The whaling ship has left the dock, and you're into open seas. You're all stuck together until you reach shore, and you don't reach shore until the show is done. It would have been nice if, like in the old whaling days, I could have, as the captain, simply thrown troublemakers overboard. But that's not how TV works. When the troublemaker is in the cast of your show, there is no throwing anyone overboard. You have to find a way to make it work, or risk being thrown overboard yourself. Because the audience won't notice if the showrunner changes, but they will notice if suddenly one of the stars of the show isn't there anymore. I'm sitting in the dark for good reasons. The first is that I'll be harder to find. I'm the boss here, the top guy. I'm covering set. But it doesn't matter. When someone starts screaming and storming off set, your job is to get them back and continue filming by any means necessary. If I've learned anything about this person, I've learned that engaging with them only makes things worse. So I'm hoping things will work out as they have in the past. The cast member will report back to the set after a cooling off period, which might be an hour. And of course, we can't even spare 5 minutes. At which point they will pretend that nothing ever happened. And that's the best outcome. Outright gaslighting. But we all go along with it because we have to. We have to get the day's work done. If we don't, the studio will blame the on-set producer, me. They don't want to hear about a cast member throwing a tantrum on set. All they want to hear is that the work got done and that a flawless episode will be delivered on time. Anything less is my fault. And I am replaceable. So here I am sitting in the darkness outside the brightly lit swamp, which brings up the second reason I'm sitting in the dark. There are water moccasins everywhere. Water moccasins are attracted to light. They like light, and they like movement, and they like noise. And tonight, we're providing them with all three. I've been told that these snakes are aggressive and confrontational. I was told this by a father and son team of snake wranglers who are now patrolling the perimeter of the set with long metal prongs shaped like sprinkler keys. They catch the snakes and put them into burlap bags and later turn them loose at the far end of the swamp. It is beyond me how they do their job. But then again, they have their snakes and I have mine. So how did I get here? Easy. My dream came true. My prayers were answered. I got to be a showrunner again. I had been convinced that this was the missing puzzle piece to my happiness. Once this happened, everything else would fall into place. Instead, everything fell apart. I had counted on the gates to save me, and instead, it was trying to kill me. To be fair, a lot of it was my fault. I fully expected the experience to be as fulfilling as it was on my first show, Miracles. I entered the gates an innocent, But once I was inside among the monsters, my innocence was lost. I'd never been on a show that felt as stubbornly unhappy as this one. A general feeling of despair hovered over the whole production from the very beginning. Paranoia, mistrust, deception, and fear. And no matter how hard I tried to turn things around, I couldn't. It was almost as if the harder I tried to improve the mood, the worse it got. I began to irrationally believe that the show itself fed on misery. It didn't want to be a good experience. And one way or another, it would figure out a way to bring everyone involved with it down to its own blighted, hopeless level. Finally, I gave up. Now, it was just something to be endured, something to be gotten through, like stomach flu. I took out my Nokia BlackBerry and stared at it. I thought about calling Susan. Maybe she was still awake. Maybe we could talk. It had been a year, and nothing had changed for us. The big thing, her desire for a second baby, and my absolute refusal to capitulate, still loomed. A year ago, when we were broke and I was unemployed, I promised Susan that once I was working again, we could reapproach the subject of having another baby. At the time, it seemed like a fair deal because I had assumed that once I was working again, I would feel secure and strong and happy and back on my feet. I would feel fed by the process, which meant I would have something left over inside of me to give to her and maybe even to another child. What I hadn't anticipated was a show that seemed determined to drain my soul every single day. If I called her, what was I going to say? I'm sitting here in the dark, hiding on the set of my own show, because I feel bad and a cast member's being mean to me. This was the kind of problem very few people would sympathize with. And I'd been going to Susan for sympathy a lot lately, and I was worried that it was starting to get a little old. You got what you wanted. You got a show. Stop complaining. Or even worse, stop pretending it isn't really what you wanted after all. The world handed you something very few people get. Quit bitching and get back to work. Now, she didn't say any of this, but if she had, I wouldn't have blamed her. There were things she wanted too, and she wasn't getting them either. Down in the swamp, one of the snake wranglers held up his metal prong. A thick brown snake, 4 feet long, twisted and whipped in the air. But the man just smiled and gently placed it inside his burlap sack. A sack that I now noticed was bulging and throbbing with a dark energy all its own. The truth was, I was tired. Tired of the show, sure, but really, I was tired of being on the opposite side of Susan. It had been over a year now, and holding my ground was becoming exhausting. Part of the feeling of depletion, of course, the biggest part, was that I couldn't go to Susan for support. I was cutting myself off from that. And for what? The reward of not having another child? There was pride involved, obviously. I didn't want to be the one to cave. But when I pictured her giving in, it almost felt worse. What was I supposed to do? It's one thing to be wrong, but it's another to go into something eyes wide open when every instinct you have tells you not to. I was convinced that having another child would ruin my life. But I had also been convinced that the gates would save it. I was wrong about the gates. What if I was wrong about both? Why are you hiding in the dark? I looked up. It was Dana, our script coordinator. I'm not hiding, I said. Well, no one can find you, so it amounts to the same thing, she said. Were people looking for me? Fuck. She sat down next to me. Here, she said, and handed me a steaming bowl of shrimp gumbo poured over a torn hunk of French bread. They could have made chicken salad, she said. They could have made cold pasta or po' boys or peanut butter and jelly. But instead, on the hottest night we've ever had, when we're all outside all night long, they make boiling gumbo. You know why, don't you? I said. Because this is hell, she said. Well, yes, that. But there's a more important reason. She stared at me in the dark, waiting for my answer. "Because I asked them not to," I said. "Poor, sad, lonely showrunner," she said. "Yep." I took a bite of the gumbo. It burned the roof of my mouth. I heard raucous laughter near the bright lights at the edge of the swamp. I looked up. The cast member had returned. They appeared to be in a good mood. I looked at my phone. 30 minutes. We'd only lost 30 minutes. There were 4 more hours to go before wrap. Then 6 more days of this episode. Then 7 more days of production after that. I wanted to go home. I wanted that more than anything in the world. Dana's walkie-talkie crackled, and I heard the voice of the assistant director. "Who's got eyes on the executive producer?" I was sure I could hear the quotation marks in his voice. Dana glanced up at me with a look that said, "What do you want me to say?" "Tell him I'm on my way," I said. And I stood up and began trudging down the hill toward the snakes and the actors and the swamp. You guys, my dream just came true. I get to do a live read ad for a product I actually use and love. I love Indian food, okay? It's probably, after like cheeseburgers, it's my second favorite of all foods. And I love meals that are healthy, fast, and simple to make. So I love the Cumin Club. Let me tell you what this is. These things, they come in packets. You order them, they deliver them right to your home. Here's the beauty. You just add water, you microwave. These things take less than 5 minutes. An Indian entree, ready to eat. It is so delicious. Okay, so let me tell you how I do it. I started off with the paneer tikka masala, which is not overly spicy. And it was perfect for me in terms of spice level. But then I did a second one. I had it with the dal chawal, which is sort of a buttery rice and lentil dish. And I mixed them together. That was my dinner. So the next day I did methi matar malai. You know, I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong. My South Asian listeners, you're going to have to tell me how badly I'm mangling this. But anyway, the methi matar malai, it's sort of a sweet, nutty cashew gravy with peas. If you've had Indian food before, I'd say this is like a korma, and it's fantastic. So I did that one with something called pav bhaj. Pav bhaj. It's a spicy veggie stew. Again, not too spicy. You don't need to be afraid. And it was the perfect lunch. Took me 3 minutes. But they've got like 20 more entrees I haven't even tried yet, so I am working my way through. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving, and that is my danger zone, because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. Like I said, you add water, you put it in the microwave, 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do. Click on the link in my show notes or simply go to thecuminclub.com and put in the offer code RHPB. That's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecuminclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB, and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first 2 orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good, healthy, and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. What am I? I'm going to go have some right now. What am I doing here? Talking about it? I'm going to go eat it. The first crack in Christine Wicker's facade of disbelief comes with a visit to Sherry Lee Calkins. This is to be a purely psychic reading filled with information about Christine's past, present, and future. Sherry, the psychic, begins the reading the instant Christine sits down. She is furiously drawing on a large blank piece of paper with the sort of crayons they give children in restaurants to keep them busy. Carrie says, "Your husband became very sick before you started dating. He almost died. He almost died again in a car accident in the country when he was in his 20s. His guardian angel saved him." Christine knew about the illness, but this second thing with the guardian angel, she'd have to check. Carrie moves on. Quote, "I'm seeing a young man, your grandfather. He's your father's father. I'm seeing an initial, but I can't tell what it is. What was his name?" Although this is fishing and she knows she shouldn't, Christine provides the name. "Dyson." "No," Sherry says, "it's not a D. What was his first name?" Christine won't be fooled again. She says she doesn't know, because she actually doesn't. Sherry stares at the crayon-covered paper in front of her and says, "It's an L. His name starts with an L. Check it out." Then she tells Christine that her grandfather had three children, although Christine only knew of two, her father and her uncle. Sherry says there was something physically wrong with the third one, and he died early. Later, Christine calls her husband and asks him if he ever almost died in the country. "Yeah," he says, "a car wreck. The car was totaled." Christine thinks. A guardian angel saved him. After she hangs up with her husband, Christine calls her mother and asks what her father's father's name was. "Leon," her mother says. "An L." Then she asks how many children there were, and her mom quickly says, "Three. But there was something wrong with one of them, a miscarriage, or he died young. I can't remember." When Christine tallies it up, she gives the session with Sherry a grand total of 8 hits and 6 misses, about a 57% hit rate, which may not sound impressive, but Christine concedes that the hits are specific and idiosyncratic, not 50-50 kinds of things, not a matter of dark hair or blonde, brown eyes or blue. In her words, quote, "The 5 times Sherry was right were not coincidence, were not good guesswork, not things she knew beforehand, and they were not facts she had elicited from me. In many cases, I didn't know the facts. Those 5 messages defied any explanation I had. She said the information came from the spirits. I don't think so, but nobody was coming up with a better story." For the first time, Christine is beginning to think she might be wrong about Lilydale. And Christine Wicker hates being wrong. Susan and Dashiell took a road trip out to Shreveport to join me for my final days on the set of The Gates. On the last day of my episode, everything went wrong. We got hit by a lightning storm that boiled up out of nowhere. We also got hit by a nuclear meltdown from our cast member, first insisting that we cut all their lines from a scene because, quote, they didn't make sense, and then a second, even bigger meltdown an hour later when they were required to be in the scene in which they had, quote, no lines. By the time I was driving back over the bridge from Shreveport to Bossier City, I was weak and trembling with fear and anger and helplessness and hopelessness and stress. But at least the final day was over. That's when I got the text. The cast member was buying dinner and drinks for the cast and crew at a restaurant near the hotel and wanted me to come. The same person that had tortured me for 12 straight hours now wanted to party with me. I absolutely couldn't believe it. But Susan wasn't surprised at all. "Your problem," she said, "is that you want them to be consistent, but they never will be. You'll never be able to figure them out or solve them. They're like that lightning storm, totally unpredictable and totally not your fault." She was right. Still, there was no way I was going to voluntarily spend another minute with this person. "Why not?" Susan said. "The worst is over. They're buying. You already suffered through their bad mood. Why cheat yourself out of their good mood?" So we went. And the cast member was more charming, more gracious, more generous, and more sincere than they had ever been. They took me aside privately and with a complete lack of irony, told me they'd never been on a better set or worked with someone who knew what they wanted so clearly, communicated it so brilliantly on the page, and then handled the production with such complete finesse as to get the very best out of everyone on set. I thought for sure they were fucking with me. I realized suddenly that their compliments were as empty and meaningless as their tirades. "Thank you," I said. Then I walked to the bar and ordered shots all around of the most expensive scotch they had. 2 hours later, we heard the news. ABC Entertainment President Steve McPherson had just resigned. Whether anyone else knew it or not, one thing was now absolutely clear to me. The Gates was dead. Christine Wicker didn't know for sure if the people she met in Lilydale had psychic powers, but one thing she did know for sure was that she didn't. And something about that knowledge made what was going to happen tonight irresistible. Tonight, there would be a demonstration in which the guests would become the psychic mediums for each other. Christine found herself doubtful, but excited, because the one person she could absolutely trust was herself. She wouldn't need to figure out if or how she was faking, because she wouldn't be faking, which meant she would fail. And there was something grounding and reassuring, even thrilling, in that knowledge. They gathered outdoors at the edge of the woods just after sunset and divided into small groups. The instructions were simple. Be quiet, close your eyes, clear your mind. And then, if the spirit moved you, if an image or a feeling came upon you, open your eyes, look around, and approach whoever seemed right. Christine closed her eyes. She was completely at ease, completely relaxed, and she felt no pressure or obligation to produce anything. She could use this time to go over her schedule for tomorrow, and she did. And as she did, she became aware of an image of a woman who she did not know. The woman was chubby and had blue eyes and fluffy white hair. It did not come to her in a flash. It was just there, like the sound of the crickets and the feel of the rapidly cooling air all around her. The woman stood in front of a table that was laid out for dinner. Like she was saying, "You're at the table. There's a place for you at the table." There was nothing shocking or startling about any of this. And there was no emotion attached to it either, because Christine knew the woman wasn't talking to her. Christine opened her eyes and immediately focused on a woman in her mid-30s. She approached this woman and simply told her what she saw. The woman looked at her like she was about to cry. "That would be my mother-in-law," she said. "I came here hoping to see her. Thank you." The woman went on to explain that she and her mother-in-law had once been very close. When she and her husband divorced, she wanted to see her ex-mother-in-law, but her ex-husband discouraged her, saying she wasn't part of the family anymore. Then the mother-in-law died, and she never got to tell her how much she meant to her. She was afraid that her ex-mother-in-law didn't know how much she loved her. And now here she was, telling her that she was still part of the family and that she still had a place at the table. This was potentially miraculous. But Christine didn't feel miraculous. Nothing about the transaction felt huge. It just felt normal, like passing on a message. Many of the mediums at Lilydale had described the process in exactly this way. But because the results were so emotionally charged for the recipient, this fact tended to get buried, overlooked. Could it really be this simple? Christine knew that there were an infinite number of images she could have received, and at least 2 dozen people she could have randomly delivered the message to. She also knew that she could have received nothing at all. But of all the possible visions she could have received, she got this one. A chubby old woman with blue eyes and fluffy white hair standing in front of a table. and it meant something to the one person she delivered it to. Or was it just two people fooling themselves? Yes, maybe that was it. That worked too. Except Christine knew that she hadn't been fooling herself. What about the woman she had given the message to? Had she been fooling herself? And what about the information Christine had received days earlier about her grandfather, who she barely knew, and her husband's car accident that he miraculously survived? No, she hadn't been fooling herself then either. Was she the only one not fooling herself? The only one approaching each interaction with at least some level of skepticism? Or did everyone come to Lilydale, hoping against hope, to find something real that would fill their hearts with hope, but also reasonably armored against disappointment, and certain they would know the difference? If you expect anything in the world of the supernatural to be consistent or correct 100% of the time, you're going to be disappointed. Before the skeptics laugh with triumph, I'll point out that it's not just the supernatural world that is inconsistent and disappointing. It's the world. Hey, my favorite writers write books I don't like. My favorite restaurants fall short on certain nights. My favorite bands have all put out albums I never listen to. My favorite directors make movies I can't stand. Sometimes my best friends let me down. Sometimes I get the one thing I have desired more than any other and find it isn't what I wanted at all. And sometimes the person I love more than anyone or anything in the world is suddenly unknown to me. And part of me thinks, how could I have been taken in so easily? How could I have been so misled? How could I have believed with all my heart in something that isn't 100% predictable? How could I have trusted something that isn't 100% correct and consistent? It is at these times that I hate myself and feel like a fool who has been told over and over again not to trust, and then goes ahead and trusts anyway. For Christine Wicker, giving herself over to total and unquestioning belief in everything Lilydale stood for would have meant losing an essential part of who she was. Yet at the same time, impossible things had happened there. It was more of a feeling than a fact. Could she trust this feeling? Could she believe it? She wasn't sure, but like so many before her, she finally decided, why not? Christine accepted that impossible things had happened in Lilydale. She lives in a new place now, somewhere between the unquestioning belief of her first 18 years and the unwavering skepticism of the next 25. Now she lives somewhere new and terrifying. It is a place both inconsistent and unpredictable, but dazzling and darkly beautiful. And she has found a way to be okay with that. On the drive back home from Louisiana, we stopped for the night in Amarillo, Texas. It was our 5th wedding anniversary, July 31st. 9 hours earlier, as we drove out of Shreveport for the very last time, I burst into tears. The gates was finally over. There was still one more episode to shoot and several in the pipeline to do production on, but for all intents and purposes, it was over. The thing I had wanted so much, the thing I had barely survived. I couldn't stop thinking about what I had done wrong, what I could have done differently, if I could have done something differently. How could I look back on what had happened and make sense of it? Even more, what had I learned? As we headed west across Louisiana and then into Texas, I kept turning it over in my mind. There is no way you could have solved it, Susan had said. And she wasn't just talking about the cast member. The show was good, but the experience of it had been terrible. And either way, it was almost certainly going to be canceled. Maybe that was the lesson. The finished product didn't matter. It was the process that mattered. Because that's where I lived. I lived in the thousands of hours of the process, not in the 13 hours that aired on network television. What if it had been an enormous hit? What if it had won Emmys? Would that have made it worth it? No, because I knew people who had been on shows like that. Years of their life spiraled down the drain in misery and stress and fear. There weren't enough Emmys in the world. There wasn't enough money in the world. At least I knew there wasn't enough for me. Being successful at that cost wasn't worth it. Maybe that was the lesson too. Success and money weren't the goal. Happiness was the goal. So now that I knew it, what was I going to do about it? While Susan tried to get Dashiell to go to sleep, I walked down a street in Amarillo looking for something she and I could drink in our motel room to celebrate our anniversary. There were no liquor stores in sight, so I stopped at a gas station mini-mart and picked up a six-pack of something called Smirnoff Ice Twisted Watermelon. Sure, it was dumb, clearly a product designed to help kids get into drinking, but for some reason, right now, it felt perfect. I walked back to the motel. It was 8:45 and not quite dark, and I stopped in my tracks when I saw a 1,000-foot wall of black clouds moving toward me across the desert from the west. Bolts of lightning exploded inside it. I had never seen anything like it. It was beautiful, and it terrified me. But at least it was new. When I got to our room, Dashiell was sound asleep. Susan had taken a shower and was wearing one of my t-shirts and nothing else. "What's that?" she said when she saw the six-pack in my hand. "It's pretty much all they had," I said. "We're in Texas," she said. "Wasn't there anything with Cuervo?" Sorry, you're right. I wasn't thinking. We filled two glasses with ice, and the bright pink stuff bubbled weakly, and we toasted our anniversary and took a sip. "Tastes like bubblegum," I said. "Bubblegum air freshener," she said, and kissed me. "Hang on," I said. "Look, I've been thinking." And then I told her what I'd been thinking. I made it sound like a big decision, one that I'd wrestled with for weeks. But really, it had just come to me in the middle of that giant, black, lightning-filled cloud. She looked at me with pure shock, like someone who has been running as hard as they can to break down a locked door, and when they get there, the door suddenly swings open in front of them. "Okay," she said. "Wow, okay. You could give a girl some warning." "I'm sorry," I said. "I thought this was what you wanted." "It is," she said. "I just need a second." I couldn't blame her. I'd done a complete 180. I wasn't even sure why. I hoped it wasn't for all the same reasons I'd ever done anything for my mom or for Michelle, because I thought making them happy was more important than making me happy. But right now, I was happy. I was leaving a nightmarish dream behind me, and hopefully heading into something better. And I was in a motel room in Texas getting drunk with a half-naked girl. A half-naked girl I loved more than anything in this world, who also happened to be my wife. We started kissing, and then more. Something had changed for me. It was a feeling more than a fact. Could I trust it? Could I believe in it? I wasn't sure, but like so many before me, I finally decided, why not? Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. We'll be right back. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we travel to the mysterious Far East with John Keel as we dive into his very first book, Jadu. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.